Hello, and welcome to the inaugural podcast from Group Effort Sound Studios. We will be bringing you a wide variety of programs covering topics surrounding the music business and studio techniques, both in audio and video formats. We recently had a chance to sit down and talk with music business veteran and longtime friend Ron Esposito. Ron has at one time or another done just about every job you can do on the business side of the music business, and we thank him for taking the time to talk with us and share his story and insights.
Yeah, I started playing music when I was 10 years old.
You play what instruments?
Presently, I play bass, acoustic and electric, small percussion, and I still know how to play guitar.
I've seen you sit down in front of a piano every now and then, too.
Yeah, you know, I'm growed on the pentatonic scales.
Very good, very good. Always safe. And a perennial classic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there you go. Okay. Love that modal stuff.
And so in the course of your life, you've been a radio DJ, you've been a promoter, you've been like a club coordinator and manager, you've been a business owner and a retail shop, you've been an agent for your own group.
And I've been a puppet, a popper, a pawn and a king.
And a road manager, which we're going to talk about. So we're going to follow this whole thing through, and we'll just investigate all of these little activities that you can do in the music business. So
cool.
You're playing, and you end up in college at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio.
Yes, I do.
And your major was?
My major when I was an undergraduate was philosophy and English literature, because I figured I'm a smart guy. I can get a job. So I went to college to get educated.
There you go.
You know.
Okay, and so you ended up working in concert promotion.
Yeah, I got on the campus entertainment committee.
Right. So what year are we talking about, essentially?
Well, I was on the campus entertainment committee from 1969 through 1972. I was on it for 3 years.
The heyday of big arena rock.
Big arena rock.
And mega groups and all that stuff.
Right. And I was instrumental in booking concerts in a 10,000-seat basketball arena at Ohio University that's called the Convocation Center. And booked people like Simon and Garfunkel, The Carpenters, James Taylor, Chicago, The Who, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and, believe it or not, Led Zeppelin on their first American tour as the opening act for Jose Feliciano.
One of these things is not like the other.
Really? And what the deal was they both had the same booking agent, Frank Barcelona at Premier Talent.
Yeah, out of New York?
Out of New York. Yeah. And Jose had a big hit on the remake of The Doors Light My Fire.
Oh, absolutely.
And, of course, Led Zeppelin was really starting to make their mark as, one of the better, heavy rock, blues rock, whatever term you want to use. And check this. I paid Led Zeppelin $1,500 as the opening act. And I want to tell you, it was incredible. It was fantastic.
So they were not really widely known at the time, being a foreign band.
Yeah, they weren't.
Right? And
they
so
really
you just
weren't.
Instantly said that this is amazing, because this is the first you'd heard of them?
Yeah, and then some guys on my dorm, guys that used to stay up all night and skip most of their classes, were into Led Zeppelin. And I checked out Led Zeppelin, and of course, I knew who Jimmy Page was, because of his work with the Yardbirds, and they were phenomenal. John Bonham, the drummer in Led Zeppelin, that guy was a master drummer.
In what way? What was his source of mastery?
It was heavy rock, but the stuff that he would throw in, like his fills, the stuff he would do on the hi-hat, and his time was just impeccable. And I thought we were going to get shut down, though, to be quite honest, because...
By whom? By campus authorities?
Yeah, campus authorities, yeah. Because I have to tell you, Led Zeppelin, particularly with Robert Plant out front with the long streaming hair down his back, you know, with the little vest and the leather pants. Oh, friends and neighbors, I want to tell you, when he started into his act and kind of did his thing on stage, it was highly charged sexually.
I see.
There it is.
Vice Squad. Okay.
There you go. Vice Squad. Yeah, yeah. So in college, yeah, we were booking nothing but the biggest groups of the day. I mean, like, take, for instance, The Who. I paid The Who $12,500 with a $6 ticket.
Wow.
Yeah. And most of the groups, you know, were playing for a guarantee against a percentage, you know, usually 60 or 70% after costs, you know, that type of thing. You know, the contracts were, of course, these, you know, like 16-page long contracts, fine print. You need a lawyer to read them and bifocals by the time you're done.
Right. Any great stage writer stories?
Yes. In fact, thank you for bringing that up. I happened to book Sly and the Family Stone, who were very, very big. You know, thank you for letting me be myself and
sure. All
those tunes. And, you know, on the writer, they're very specific what they want for hospitality. Okay, you know, for PA, for hospitality, for the back line, all
right.
This
hospitality would be the backstage stuff, you know,
right? Yeah, the food and drink, the amenities, all that kind of stuff. And I tell you what, I always paid very close attention to all that stuff. You know, if it was on the contract, you got it. You know, unless we negotiated it somehow.
Right, because if something was impossible, you could say, "Well, listen, I can't get you."
Yeah, I can't get this. Yeah. Right, exactly. So anyway, Sly, I got all the Sly stuff, you know, roast beef, ham, you know, the whole, everything he wanted. He pulls up in this limousine, late, of course.
Yeah, fashionably late.
Fashionably late, yeah, right. He was styling and profiling. And I said, "Hey, Sly, how you doing, man? It's good to have you here, et cetera, et cetera." And he had these dark sunglasses on that he kind of just lowered a little bit and said, "I want a bologna sandwich in an orange." I said, "Well, I tell you what, man, we can fix you up with the orange, but we don't have any bologna. That wasn't on the rider. I got roast beef. I've got ham. I've got all this kind of stuff." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, you know, I'm not going to get out of this car until I get a bologna sandwich and an orange." And I looked at him, and here's where I definitely put on the promoter.
Uh-huh.
You know, on one hand, I was really gassed that I was like this 21-year-old guy booking the greatest bands in the world at that time. But, you know, hey, I'm in charge of a multi-thousand-dollar operation here, and
you're not prepared to make it tank just because somebody wants a bologna sandwich and an orange.
Exactamundo.
Right.
So, you know, he laid this thing out on me, and I looked at him, and I said, "Well, I'll get right back with you." So I went and had a little chat with some of my cohorts, and I decided to call his bluff. So I went back to the car, knocked on the window. He rolled the window down. He said, "Well, you got my sandwich?" And I said, "I'll tell you what, brother, I don't have your sandwich. But what I do have for you is about 8,000 people who have paid good money to come here and see you. And you know what I'm going to do? In 5 minutes, I'm going to walk out onto that stage and I'm going to say, 'Hey, Sly's in the back, but he won't come out and play for y'all. What do you think about that?' So, Mr. Sly, why don't you think about it? You got 5 minutes, and when you see me walking to the stage, I think you better be walking behind me, don't you?" And he looked at me, and he didn't say anything, okay? Well, 5 minutes later, I start walking to the stage, and about 10 seconds after that, I hear a limo door close. And guess who was behind me?
I assume he was all tuned up and ready to go, too.
Well, you know, there was enough of the band out there to get it going.
All right. Well,
you know, and it's interesting because, you know, at a certain point, if you're in the business, it's a business. And, you know, half of being a promoter is being a psychologist and knowing how to work with people and all this. But the other part of it is, hey, you know what? You're getting paid thousands of dollars here to play, my man. And
we have an agreement.
And we have an agreement. That's right.
Yeah,
we got a signed agreement here. So, you know, I'm ready to go to the mat. How about you?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, yeah, and that's basically, and you're talking about thousands and thousands of people. And
yeah, right, exactly. You know, I remember I booked Emerson, Lake, and Palmer and West, Bruce, and Lang were the opening act, you know, Leslie West and Jack Bruce. And Leslie West was incensed that they were going to be the opening act. And he locked himself in the dressing room, refused to come out until I got somebody to open up for them.
I'm not coming out.
Exactly. You know, and I'm yelling at Leslie. I'm going, we got a signed contract. I'm going to call your agent. He goes, I'm not coming out till you get somebody to open up for us. And it was like, you know, I'm going to kill these people.
So who'd you get?
This is why I love jazz musicians, okay?
A little less pretense.
A little less pretense,
yeah,
right.
Okay.
So anyway, I called up. There was this bluegrass guy in Athens by the name of Lost John Hutchison. And he was a great guitar player, and he could tell stories. I called him up. At that time, he was washing dishes at the Casa Que Pasa. It's a Mexican kind of restaurant.
Yeah.
So I get John on the phone. I go, yeah, homie, you want to make $100 for 15 minutes? He said, well, who do I have to kill? And I said, well, brother, here it is. I got a big show down at the Convocation Center, and I need an opening act to go on before the opening act.
Oh, and it's 8,000 people.
Yeah. And by the way, right, it's 8,000 people who don't know who the hell you are. It might not listen to you, but, hey, it's 15 minutes, and it's $100,
and
that's all you got to do. And he said, I'll be right there. I said, great. So he came down. He went out on stage. He did not talk at all. I mean, all he did was sing and play his guitar. And he didn't wait for applause or anything. He just did it straight through for 15 minutes. I had a $100 bill as he was walking off the stage. As he was walking off the stage, there's Leslie West grinning from ear to ear as he's ready to go on to the stage with his band because he was not the opening act in his eyes.
And you have satisfied his every need.
I did. And as a little footnote, years later when I was working out of New York, I happened to road manage Leslie for a few days on the road.
Yeah.
And it was a highly interesting affair.
Well, we'll get to that later.
Yes, we will.
Your story career. We're only just right at the beginning here.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the mechanics of doing promotion.
Okay.
This is where we're at right now. So you've got a large hall. Were there any kind of formulas that you developed in terms of, you know, ticket price versus number of people versus how full the hall had to be or any?
Yeah, I mean, right. So, I mean, one of the first things you do is you figure up, what are my expenses? Okay. Let's take, for instance, the Who. All right. So I got $12,500 in the band. Okay. Then PA. Whatever PA was going for back then, you know, PA and lights, okay? And usually PA and lights came as a package deal. Usually the PA company and the lighting company were the same company, you know.
Right.
So, and then, of course, you have security. I can't remember if the university was actually charging us rent on the hall or not, since all the money was going to the university.
Right.
But anyway, you know, you got your expenses. So you figure up what your expenses are.
Did you figure in backstage stuff like stage writer kinds of things, or was that
of
just?
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Right. What's hospitality going to cost me?
Yeah.
What's a hotel going to cost me? You know, what's advertising going to cost? All of those things. Okay. So you get your costs in line, and then you go, okay, well, we got 10,000 seats. You know, here's what I need to break even. And then, you know, you never figure on selling out. I always looked at the sellout as gravy. So I was always trying to make my nut on less than the sellout. So
like what, 60%, 70%?
Yeah, probably around 70%.
Okay.
You know, so if you do the math, we had a 10,000 seat hall and a $6 ticket charge for the Who. So this is a $60,000 gross potential. Okay.
Right.
So heck, even if we had 8,000 people there, we grossed $48,000. So you could see that it was a numbers game. You know, the more people you could put in, the cheaper the ticket price could be.
Right.
But you had to do the business.
Right.
Now, of course.
Which meant that the people who were performing had to have the potential to draw that many people.
Right. And then, you know, like you've heard the people that we were booking, we were booking nothing but the top acts of the day. You know, there was a great potential for us to make money as well as the artist, you know, in the split. When you're doing shows with that large a hall, at least at that time, you know, everybody really knew the real money was in the split. It wasn't in the guarantee. But you had to have a guarantee, of course, you know.
Right. Okay. So any spectacular failures?
The closest we came was that Sly and the Family Stone thing, because the concert started late and, you know, when I called his bluff, he folded.
Right.
So there we went. But with that said, the guy only played 45 minutes, too.
Oh.
And at that point, to be quite honest, I just wanted to get that whole thing over with and get that guy out of my sight.
So would it be a fair statement to say that you wouldn't be inclined to hire Sly the next time?
No, I never wanted to have anything to do with Sly ever again under any circumstance, no matter how cleaned up or how gentlemanly he may have become.
Yeah, so you essentially you reap what you sow in this business.
Well, yeah, because it's a small business, man. You really cannot afford to burn bridges in this business. It's really interesting because the way things in this business work, things can turn on a dime, and they have, you know. I mean, they really have. I mean, if you look at the way particularly the large promoters are these days, you know, all the regional promoters never thought they would work for Clear Channel, but they did.
Yeah.
You know, at one point in time, you know, the Belkin brothers in Cleveland and Steve Libertor here in Cincinnati.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's cool. So, away from college?
Yeah, I graduated from college, yeah.
Firmly in hand, and you head for Boston.
Yeah, I head to Boston because I had a band while I was in college. Well, we were too scared to go to New York.
What were you called?
Oh, you don't
know. Oh, no,
really.
I got to know.
Come on.
Oh, no. You got to tell me.
All right. It was an acoustic-oriented group. Oh, God. It was called the Odious Melodious String Band.
Oh, I'm so glad I asked that question.
Oh, God.
Okay, so the Odious Melodious translates to Boston because you were too scared to go to New York.
Yeah, we were. Right. And the flute player in the band was from Boston. So we moved to Boston, and of course, we promptly break up, you know?
Over what? I got to know over what.
Everybody had to go get a job, you know? I mean, we had to pay to live. And so everybody went and got day jobs, except for yours truly. I was trying to live the dream.
Yeah.
But everybody went and got a day job, and then, you know, just kind of the whole thing blew up.
And nobody just wanted to play, and there were no gigs, and...
Yeah,
and
right. It was all just...
You're on to the next thing.
On to the next thing, yeah. Right, exactly.
So you found work as an assistant manager at the Jazz Workshop.
Yeah. Now, this is really, you know...
Is the first time you've done anything like that? Manage a club?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and interesting. So you just figured, well, I can do this. So I'm just going to go do it.
Well, what it was for me was when the group imploded there in Boston, I had to make a decision. It's like, well, am I going to go get a day job or what am I going to do? And like in one of those dark nights of the soul type things, I had to think, well, what turns me on? What lights me up? I said, music and musicians. Okay, so what are you going to do? Well, you got to go be with the music and the musicians. Well, where's that? Well, there's this jazz club in downtown Boston, the Jazz Workshop, that all the greatest jazz musicians play at. Well, that would be a place I would want to be. So I went down there, and I walked in, you know, one afternoon. And, of course, you never want to walk into a club in the daylight. Oh, whoa.
That doesn't have the same quite as appeal.
No, they always look better at night with the lights down. Okay?
Correct.
So, you know, I walked in, and the manager of the club was this big guy, 6'8", ex-Boston Celtic, Big Dick Stasium was his name. And, you know, he said, well, what can I do for you? And I told him, just flat out, I said, I'd like to have a job here. And he said, well, what are you going to do here? And I said, I'm going to do anything that needs to be done here. And he said, oh, I'm going to give you a job, and you're going to do anything that needs to be done here. I said, you got it. That's right. Exactly. And he said, well, and how much money am I supposed to pay you to do this? I said, you're supposed to pay me whatever you're paying. I want a job here. He said, well, okay, we'll try you out. How's that? I said, great. He said, well, last night there was a bachelor party in here, and these boys got a little rowdy with the champagne and threw up all over the men's room. I think that's your job for today. I said, give me the mop and bucket, bud. I'm off to work. You know?
Right.
So, you know, for 2 weeks, I did menial stuff until, you know, they figured out, oh, this guy's straight. He's sober. He shows up on time. He does what he says he's going to do. Maybe
no job too small.
Yeah, no job too small. Right. Yeah. Exactamundo. So after 2 weeks, I'm a doorman. You know, I'm the guy that takes your money before you go into the club.
Right. And you obviously have great people skills, so I'm sure you were a hit at that.
I was a hit.
You're making friends with the people coming in, goodwill with the patrons.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So after a couple months of working on the door, they go, oh, well, this guy definitely can do this. Why don't we make him assistant manager of the whole operation? So I was like, yeah, that's a very good idea.
You know, it's an interesting thing about when you're the doorman for a club, you are the face of that organization.
Yeah, you are.
You know,
right.
To the public. They come in, they see you before they see anybody else. They probably never see the owner.
Oh, no, right, yeah. Right. In fact, the owners really want to be low-key, you know, because they don't want everybody hitting them up for free drinks and can I get in for free?
And right, they don't want to be a target. Yeah,
yeah right, yeah. Exactly, you know, so... So, you know, I became, I learned, one, the bar business. Don't ever kid yourselves, and this is the truth, ladies and gentlemen, musicians. The nightclub business is the liquor business. The music is all about getting people in so the club can sell liquor. If you're not selling drinks, you're of no use to the club. Generally speaking, sad to say, but that's the club business.
That's where it is.
That's the club business. So, you know, that's the reality of things. And I don't think that's changed in a million years. Okay.
Since we played jazz with rocks and sticks.
Right. When Barney Rubble and Fred Flintstone were hanging out, you know. So, you know, I learned the bar business. You know, I managed the bar and managed waitresses and managed the musicians who played there. And the musicians who played there were incredible.
Did you book the musicians?
No, I did not book the musicians. The owners of the club booked the musicians.
The owners did, or did they do it through an agent?
No, the owners did.
Okay, so they really had ties to the community.
They did. And these guys that owned the Jazz Workshop in Boston, you know, they were the big jazz promoters in New England. So you know, they were like the George Wine or George Ween of New England. So everybody knew them in the business. So they booked people like Miles Davis, Chick Corea, Elvin Jones, McCoy Tyner. You see where it's going.
Sure. What era are we talking about?
We're talking 19. I started work there in 1972.
Oh, okay. So this is the golden era.
Yeah, that's right, man. Yeah. Herbie Hancock with the M1 DC Septet, you know, Miles.
Prior to the Headhunters?
Right. Just before he went and did the Headhunters. You know, Miles Davis, you know, with the bubbling, oozing cauldron on the corner stuff. So, I mean, this was real deal. And for a guy who was into music, and particularly jazz, I was in heaven, believe me.
So
totally in heaven.
You'd been working there 4, 5, 6 months by the time you were working with the artists?
No. Well, yeah, a little less, maybe about 3 or 4 months, actually.
Amazing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, this must have seemed like a fairy tale.
It was. It was. It did seem like a fairy tale to me. Hey, here I am. I'm like 22 years old, and I'm going out every night with Charles Mingus. While his group is playing, you know, here we are. I'm 22 years old, and I'm hanging out with Herbie Hancock every night after the gig. I'm hanging out with, you know, Elvin Jones, McCoy Tyner, you know, you name it. They all played the club, and I got along with them. They got along with me because I respected them, and I came first from that place of respect, but also knowing this is a business. And we got to do the business, and we have to take care of business. So we're going to start on time. The breaks are of a certain length. We start the sets on time. You know, this kind of stuff.
All right. Did you ever run into resistance? It seems like a guy like Miles would be totally inclined to blow you off.
Well,
when it comes to that kind of thing.
And that's very well stated, Bill. And, you know, we were a little more flexible with an artist like Miles.
Okay.
Because, you know, look, Miles Davis... He's like the Beethoven of his time.
What can you
know?
Say? Yeah.
What can you say?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as long as Miles played his two sets, it's like as long as he got on there in a reasonable amount of time, you know, you kind of with guys like Miles, they're special guys.
Right. But by and large, when people see that you're focused about business, they treated you as such and were
Absolutely.
Mostly cooperative.
Right.
Yeah.
Mostly, I mean,
this
because...
This is our policy at our club. And,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, when bands walked in, I knew who the guys were in the band, you know, because I'm a jazz freak, you know? I knew their tunes, their discographies. I treated them like, we're really glad to have you here. The piano's tuned. All the stuff that musicians would want
right.
to play to the best of their capabilities. And we never really had any problems. Every once in a while, you know, God bless Larry Coryell. At that period in his life, you know, admittedly.
Was this the 11th House era?
Yeah, he was a very real alcoholic and drug addict, okay? And that he was a bit erratic at times, okay? Hey, God bless Larry now. He's cleaned up and a brilliant musician. He was a
Absolutely.
Brilliant musician then, too, but his behavior was erratic. But, you know, that's the only guy I can recall that I ever really, you know, I had to hold his hand a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's
You
good.
Know, that kind of thing, you know?
How long was your stint in Boston with the
Yeah, about a year and a half. I knew that sooner or later— I was going to work in New York. If you're in the music business and you want to be in the big-time music business, you know, you want to work in New York at least once. So I knew that I was going to get there sooner or later. Now, Buddy Rich had already played the club and asked me to go on the road with him as a road manager. And I asked a few of my close compatriots, well, what do you think it would be like to work for Buddy Rich?
And now, after the existence of the Buddy Rich bitch out tapes, which are so prevalent,
right.
everybody knows what it was like to work
exactly.
for Buddy Rich.
Exactly. Yeah. Everybody that I consulted to a person said, you know, he's a great musician, but he can be a little bit of an SOB. You may want to pass on Buddy, and which I did. Okay. But my meal ticket to New York wasn't too far after that. There was a Brazilian keyboard player and arranger by the name of Umir Diodato, who in about 1972 or 73 had a really big crossover smash with a remake of Richard Strauss's Thus Sprach Zarathustra.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, so Umir did a really hip arrangement and kind of funked it up a little bit. And lo and behold, you know, that record is selling like wildfire. The label has to get him out on the road to start to capitalize on this hit. So what a lot of guys did before, you know, they would go on major concert tours, they would spend, you know, a week playing in a club every night to get the stuff together.
Right.
Because, I mean, they're pro musicians.
Rehearsal, but you need to coalesce.
Right. Yeah, you need to coalesce. Everybody can read, you know, the charts, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what Diodato did. He got booked in to the Jazz Workshop in Boston to get his band ready to go on the road. And he was a very nice guy. And he liked me a lot. And when they were getting ready to leave, he asked me if I wanted to go on the road with them as their road manager and move to New York. And I said yes. And within just a couple weeks, I was out of Boston in New York.
Let me ask, not to interrupt, but let me ask you, did you see this juncture in your thing as like, well, I've taken the club thing about as far as I can go and I'm looking for something else, or did this appear to you to be like a door opening?
For me, I saw it as a door opening.
It's not like you were looking to get the hell out of the club, but this was the real opportunity and an entree into New York.
Right. I mean, I knew I wanted to work in New York, and I was very happy working at the club because, hey, I got to hang out with the greatest musicians in the world every night of the week.
Huge networking opportunity, too, though you didn't think of it that way.
Right. On many levels, I was still a fan, so to speak, you know, but had a job.
Interacting with these people.
Yeah, interacting. Right, exactly. Right. I mean, I have many, many stories I could tell, but, you know, we could. That's another 5-hour
tape. That's part three.
Yeah. Right. I could tell you about putting Charles Mingus's pickup on his lion's head bass and hooking it into his blue sparkle custom
amp.
Oh, yeah,
with the pleated.
Yeah, right, exactly, right, right, yeah. Those kinds of things, you know. So anyway, I viewed the gig with Diodato as I'm going to move to New York. I'm going to work in the music business in New York. I'm going to go on the road. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things coalescing at once for me.
Right. So you didn't have to move to New York to go on the road with Diodato.
No, right, yeah.
But, you know, the road manager gig sprung forth from there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When it was all over, you had to be there anyway.
Right, yeah. I mean, I got to move to New York with a gig.
Yeah.
Instead of moving to New York and trying to find a gig, you know, that kind of thing.
So you ended up at CTI, Creed Taylor Industries.
Yeah, CTI Records, which was one of the better mainstream jazz record labels in the country at that time. A very solid stable of artists like Freddie Hubbard, Hubert Laws, George Benson, you know, Umir Diodato, Flora and Airto, Stanley Turrentine, you know, just to name a few. And one of the other bonuses was that CTI did all their recordings with Rudy Van Gelder.
Oh, man.
At Rudy's studio in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. And I got to go to Rudy Van Gelder's all the time. I got to be in the booth while Rudy recorded whoever. Now, Rudy did wear white gloves, and you could not touch the board.
Oh, I'm sure.
And in fact, you had to kind of be over in the corner so that you couldn't see what Rudy was doing at the board.
Very strange. It's kind of like the Michael Jackson secretive weirdo guy in the recording industry.
Yeah, exactly.
White gloves.
White gloves. That's so that the oils from his fingers
wouldn't
get on his equipment.
Well, I'm sure there was a no smoking policy.
Oh, yeah. There definitely was no smoking.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And back in those days, to have a no smoking policy, That was really something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because everybody was smoking.
So I'm just curious, as the road manager, why are you at the recording sessions?
I was at the recording sessions.
Because you had the privilege to be? Or
Well, I guess because of my relationship with the artists. The artists that I worked for as a road manager knew that I respected them to the maximum as human beings and as artists. And they knew that, yeah, I wanted to get paid like everybody else, but I really approached this as like a lifestyle. This is my dream. I'm living my dream. I'm with guys that are making records every day. I'm with guys that are touring the world every day. I'm like a pig and you know what. You know, so when they went to go record, it was like, there was never even a question of me not going because I would go. I would help you set your drums up. I would help carry your amplifier.
Okay, so as road manager in a recording environment, you kind of helped them with their gear and roadie and set up.
Yeah,
and all that stuff.
Yeah. And just, you know, just to have everybody be in a good head so that they make the best record that they can make.
Right.
You know,
attitude's so important.
It is. Yeah, exactly. And these guys are all pro players, okay? You know,
but even still, when you're talking about a music like jazz, it's all about, you know, the moment and all that stuff.
Yeah,
and just
right.
One really bad event at the
right.
session can really put a pall.
Yeah, yeah. So you want, you know, and I love these guys. I loved how they played. God, they were great players, man.
Ron Esposito, emotional liaison.
Yeah, very well stated, which would serve me later. You know, in many other capacities.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
It's the people skill thing again in
right.
a different context.
Right. That's exactly right. That's 100%.
So
right.
The initial road manager gig was Diodato. So exactly
right.
What does the road manager do?
Okay. So back in that time period, in the early 70s.
Your mode of travel was mostly?
Our mode of travel, believe it or not, mostly was airplane. And I got it, well, because there was a lot of money coming in.
Okay. Huge, yeah, huge breakout artist.
Yeah,
okay.
Huge breakout artist. Money was rolling in faster than it could be counted. And we actually traveled in the initial stages mostly by air every day. But I tell you what, once we started doing that, it was like, you know what? Why don't we fly from New York to Chicago, get a bus in Chicago and tour, you know, the Midwest, you know, the four or five states in that bus instead of having to schlep the equipment every day to the airport. Try to fly the equipment as excess baggage by tipping the SkyCap $100, you know.
Right, and the whole disconnects, it's so inconsistent.
Oh, yeah, you know, and having to rent a truck every day. It was got to be grueling.
And so that was all your job.
Yeah, it was all my job. You know, it was the logistics, the luggage, the equipment, the hotel, the transportation, the payment. Yeah, that's the road manager was in charge of every detail that pertained to keeping the group on the road doing business and performing. I mean, we even stayed only in Holiday Inns because they're all the same. And you wanted that predictability, sameness.
So when you were out of the gig and you were staying in a place, at least there was something familiar in your life.
Right, exactly. Right, because when we were going out, I mean, some of these tours, you know, you'd go out for 2 and 3 months at a time. It was like, I mean, for real.
How many dates a week, typically?
Maybe four.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd have a layover day or
travel day
yeah. You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I would be out on the road with, thousands upon thousands of dollars.
In cash
yeah. And some
because part
some
of your job was getting paid
checks.
By the
yeah,
promoter
sure.
at the
yeah,
end of the
right.
night.
Paid by the promoter. I got to pay the musicians, take care of the per diems, you know, for meals. You know, all of that, doing the business.
Wow.
I had a money belt. You know, it's a big belt that you wear underneath your clothes that holds the money.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
securities would be a huge thing.
Yeah,
like
but, you know, we never really fretted over it.
But it was something you had to think about.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go to some nightclub after the gig with $20,000 in cash on me. I would go back to the hotel, put it in the safe, then go to the nightclub. You know, that kind of thing.
Who else did you work with as?
When Diodato wasn't working, I worked for another Brazilian crew, the great percussionist Ayrton Moreira and his wife Flora Purim, who were some of the most wonderful, beautiful human beings I'd ever encountered in my life. Whenever they wanted to go talk business with Creed Taylor, they would have me come with them because, you know, they spoke English, but sure, they wanted to make sure they were being understood. You know, and at that time, a lot of artists were, like, starting to cross over, you know? And Flora and Ayrton weren't about crossing over. So I remember one day we were in Creed Taylor's office, and Ayrton just gushes out, "We are not commercials." You know, we're going to play our stuff from the heart, and if you want it, great.
Creed kind of pushing him to say maybe you could do something a little more?
Well, you know, Creed was, you know, he saw what happened with Diodato, okay?
Right. Yeah.
So he was like, well, yeah, let's all...
This works.
Let's make some money.
Yeah.
You know.
I've got a great Ayrton story, by the way. I saw him in Bogart's in the early 70s before it was the huge monolithic tomb of death that it is now.
Oh, yeah.
But Ayrton had two gigantic percussion setups on opposite sides of the stage. Uh-huh. And the floor was in the middle.
Right.
And he had this, you know, one group of stuff on one side and a big table. And he was playing one tune, and it was a relatively quiet tune, but he decided there was something on the other table, on the other side of the stage, that he desperately needed right now.
Oh.
So he goes running over to the table, trips right at the table, falls into the table, makes this huge random crash, Flora stops singing and says, "He embarrasses me." Anyway.
I used to babysit their daughter, you know?
Yeah?
Yeah, when she was born. Also, I worked for Stanley Clark as well as a transport guy.
Bus driver?
I had a van in New York. So Stanley, he had all his bases and equipment.
Oh, cartage.
Cartage, that's okay. Yeah, because, you know, when I wasn't on the road, I'd do cartage for a lot of studio guys. And studios were happening almost 24 hours a day up there. It was not uncommon for guys to do three sessions a day if you were, you know, one of the first call players. And, of course, Stanley Clark was. And it's interesting. He and I were the same age. But we never kind of got along like we were the same age. It was kind of like I worked for him. But, hey, that's okay.
Well,
it's no big
you did.
Deal. I did, right. I did.
So, but you weren't able to establish that kind of rapport.
Yeah, I didn't have a rapport. Yeah.
Get a wall up.
Yeah, I didn't have a rapport with Stanley like I have with Flora and Ayrton. God, I was like, you know, mia familia with them. You know what I'm saying.
Sure. So the road manager gigs, how many of those? Was it one into another, or you had breaks where you would do cartage? So how many months?
For the first year, it was pretty fast and furious with not too many breaks. The breaks might have only been maybe a month here or there break. You know, like we would go out for 2 months and come back for a month, go out for a month, be off 2 weeks, go out for 2 months, kind of those kind of things, you know. I mean, in fact, when we came back to New York, I hardly knew anybody in New York because everybody I knew I was on the road with. And so it was not uncommon for me to stay at the airport, call some girl I knew in Chicago, and ask her what she was doing for dinner that night, and just fly to Chicago,
right.
You know, hang out in Chicago for the weekend and, you know, come back to New York a few days later, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, also, yeah, one other.
Yeah.
I road managed the CTI Jazz All-Stars package.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that was a great package. Now, Jack Dejanette on drums, Ron Carter on bass, Bob James,
right.
Keyboard and arranger. He would lead the groups. George Benson on guitar, Milt Jackson vibes, you know, Stanley Turrentine, sax, Hubert Laws, flute, you know, that whole kind of lineup. And Esther Phillips singing. And that was really fantastic. it was really, yeah, those people had been around and they were very seasoned players and, you know, so it was great being on the road with them.
You got out of that eventually. Is it just road life is hard and you needed to get out?
I tell you what happened to me, Bill. Yeah, road life is hard. But what happened to me, and I don't think this is very uncommon, to be quite honest. When people really start to make money in the music business, I mean,
artists.
They can be players.
Artists.
Yeah, artists.
Yeah.
You know, they might be doing record sessions and doing club dates and, you know, they're making a living as an artist. But when you start to have a hit record and start to have hit records, the scale of income starts to really change drastically. And also the size of your head can change too.
it's a proportion.
Yeah, it is
a
proportion.
Yeah.
And what happened was I started hearing people talk less and less about music and more about their leather outfits and all of that kind of stuff. So,
some of the trappings that you get.
Yeah,
with
some of the trappings, you know. So it was kind of getting ready for me to go back to me playing music. So after a couple years on the road with the people with CTI and, you know, doing the Cartage thing.
Crazy schedules and hours.
You know, it's interesting, you know, because Diodato was managed by Bud Prager and Gary Kerr first, who ended up having the Talking Heads. They had Mountain at the time that we were managed by them. And so, you know, it's funny. I got to be friends with Leslie West after a few years prior. You know what I'm saying? It's interesting. But anyway.
Do they remember you from that time? Or
you know, I never brought it up with Leslie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just.
I'm not coming out.
Yeah, there wasn't any real point to it.
Well, exactly.
So, actually, I moved back to southeastern Ohio, Athens, Ohio, where I was, where I went to undergraduate school, and I went back to playing music. You know, I put a quartet together, and we started playing regionally.
Yeah,
you know?
What kind of music were you
playing? We played kind of groove-oriented jazz that you could dance to, because we were playing basically college bars, but we weren't playing rock and roll. We wanted to play, you know, improvisational jazz-oriented music. We weren't playing bebop,
but with the expanded harmony that comes with
jazz.
Yeah,
right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. We were. It was interesting. You know, we were
playing electric.
Yeah, I was playing electric bass with electric piano, saxophone, and drums. You know,
and the name of this band was
Rania. R A N I A.
And we'll look for it on iTunes.
Yeah. There. Yeah. There you go. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did that for. I don't know, about maybe about 3 years or so. And I started working on the radio when I went back to Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, as a air talent?
Yeah, as a jazz disc jockey.
Yeah, how'd you get that? Did you walk in and say, you, Phil, hire me to...
It was interesting. There was a dude named Martin who kind of was taking care of the jazz jocks. And I went up there one day and introduced myself to Martin. I said, hey, I'm Ron Esposito, blah, blah, blah. I used to work with blah, 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 ding, dong, ding. And I said, hey, man, I'd love to spend some jazz on the radio. And he said, great, man, when can you start? You know, it was like somebody that's been around like you, you know, we want, you know.
First time you'd been in front of a board and all that stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I've been in front of sound boards, so.
Yeah, I know from being a sound guy that the music and recording industry equipment is vastly different than broadcast.
Yeah, the broadcast stuff is much more stripped down.
But there's a whole different set of things that surround being in broadcast, like, you know, having to break for network news
those component things. And I tell you what, you know, the biggest thing I had to learn as a disc jockey?
What was that?
Is edit yourself when talking.
Yeah?
Yeah. I might think that I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread in what I have to say about the music and the artists, but you know what? Ultimately, people want to hear the music.
Yeah. So not too much surrounding perspective.
Yeah, you learn really over time to self-edit your raps. You know, you can say stuff, but, you know, the more edited it is, actually, the more impact you'll have.
More succinct and more to the point.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
And every guy that was incarcerated in southeastern Ohio listened to my radio show. I became very well known in the prison system of southeastern Ohio. There was two or three prisons in southeastern Ohio. And particularly black guys who were into jazz from larger cities knew who Ron Esposito was and listened to me religiously. In fact, they wrote to me, and I would go visit them in prison.
Really?
Yeah.
So did you ever do your show from prison? Or,
no, I never did.
Or anything like that?
No, I never did that, but the prison officials knew me too.
So you're playing and you're on the radio. It's been your first experience. How was it to be like recognized by your voice? You know, because interesting story. Hey, this is much later in your timeline here, but I was you have a very distinctive manner of speaking and vocal quality.
Mm-hmm.
And I was after hearing you on the radio here in Cincinnati back in the 80s for however many months, you just couldn't. I was in a room. It was a release party for somebody. And I hear your voice coming from all right. Ron Esposito is in this room, and I had never even met you at that point.
Yeah, my voice is my fingerprint.
So how was that to come to terms with that? Was that the first time you had come to understand this about your voice?
You know, I think so. To be quite honest, because prior to that, I wasn't working on the radio. I was with musicians and working in the business. But yeah, it became apparent to me that, and I never thought much about it, of course, that I do have a distinctive voice, at least to many people, and that that if you heard it regularly, it kind of really sticks with you.
Well, it's certainly instantly recognizable.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
like, you know, a Ben Webster tenor sax sound
exactly,
or something
right.
like that.
Sure, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it was gratifying and humbling. I was highly appreciative of the recognition, and I think the biggest thing I learned was that thing I learned when I worked in New York with these guys is you got to keep your head on. It's like if you start believing your own hype, you're going to go off the deep end. So I appreciated being recognized and complimented and all of that, but I kind of kept it in perspective that, you know, I'm in service to the music was kind of my motto.
And you're in Athens and not on WABC.
Yeah, right. So there was 50,000 watts in Athens, but mostly cows, you know, and guys in prison.
FM or AM?
FM.
FM. Okay, so you didn't really have national coverage at night way you do on AM.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, so you're playing and you're DJing, but at some point, higher education.
Yeah, you know, I got to a point, I was getting into my late 20s, you know, kind of had
did,
one of those.
Did the DJ thing pay?
No, it didn't. No, it was volunteer.
And no chance of it ever becoming a pay gig because that's the way the thing was constructed.
It was kind of, you know, unless I got hired as staff at WOUB. Yeah,
so no reason to stay on the radio for any financial aspect.
Right. Though while I was in Athens, it was a great thing to do. So, you know, when I decided to go to graduate school, because I was kind of having some kind of like existential thoughts of like, well, pretty soon you're going to be 30 years old and what the hell are you doing, you know?
But you're a pre-midlife crisis.
Yeah, kind of.
Just emotional.
Yeah, right. I thought, well, you know, I'll go to graduate school and I'll get a master's degree. And it was like, well, what are you going to get a master's degree in, bro? I thought, well, it's got to be something related to the music business, entertainment industry, et cetera. And really, and the closest thing that I could see that came was radio. You know, so I got my master's degree in radio television management. Now, it's interesting enough, while I was in graduate school, I worked as the assistant program director for television, and I did get paid some money for doing that, and you know, still worked on the radio.
But that was labor of love.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And I loved doing radio. I did. I loved it. I think one of the things I liked about it, and you'll get a big kick out of this, Bill, is because I could go in during the daytime into a studio and bring all the lights down low.
and pretend like it was 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a low light guy. Bill, Bill's known this for me for years.
Ron comes in to do sessions, and the first thing is like, not like, well, where do I plug in? It's like, can you lower the lights?
Yeah, I like feeling in that cocoon. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah, man.
You know, that's one of the great things about studios is that sense of isolation that you get.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's like
yeah.
being in your creative cocoon.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why I love them. It's interesting. When I lived in New York the first time, I cut my first demos at Electric Ladyland Studios, Electric Lady Studios,
yeah.
Jimi Hendrix's place
sure.
in New York, with Eddie Kramer Engineering. It was the first time I was in a recording studio. And actually, I'm so freaked out that the guitar player had to finish my tracks. I was, one, freaked out because it was Jimi Hendrix's studio. Two, I've never heard myself with earphones on playing.
Yeah.
And it kind of like freaked me out. I mean, I played a lot live, but I never heard it like you hear it in a studio with headphones on. You
yeah.
know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And it kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Why, the clarity of it?
Yeah, I mean, just everything about it, you know?
Yeah.
Like I heard myself like I never heard myself before. Now it's like, I love it, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
It's fantastic. But then it was a little disconcerting for me, and I got a little freaked out. So,
well, I can see, yeah, with Eddie Kramer sitting behind.
Right,
the
and you know Hendrix's studio. There wasn't a right angle in that whole place. Everything was curving and undulating.
Well, it's kind of like our studio out there. Even the floor and the ceiling are.
Yeah, and just as a little asterisk, yeah. My continuing run-ins with Leslie West when I was cutting my demos at Electric
yeah.
Lady, he was working on a record down the hall. Yeah. So, you know, I worked on the radio while I was in graduate school, and, you know, I had a couple bands, you know, that one group, Rainia, and I had another group, a trio, bass, drums, and electric piano called ARC, named after that Chick Corea record
right.
that Dave Holland, Barry Altschul, and Chick did that just parted my wig completely.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So
2 years in grad
yeah,
school?
Yeah, 2 years in graduate school. So in 1980, I get my master's degree in broadcast management. So I figure I'm going back to New York.
Let's go manage some broadcasts.
Yeah. I have to tell you, honestly, I was looking to get back into the music business.
Right.
So,
but at this time, you're an experienced enough DJ doing this kind of thing. You could go into any station that would allow you to play what you wanted to play. And
yeah, I could have. Right. You know, and it's funny, working professionally, you know, for pay on the radio didn't quite yet occur to me. It did later. But
yeah.
at that point in 1980, it didn't. I kind of just still viewed it as, well, this is what I do here for WOUB. So when I went back to New York in 1980...
Anything waiting for you there?
Actually, I ended up with a position with an independent label called PM Records, run by the bassist Gene Perla, who had a group called Stone Alliance with Don Elias, the drummer and percussionist, Bobby Mincer on the saxophones, and the late Kenny Kirkland on keyboards. Yeah, that was a hot band, believe me. So, one, I was managing that group and also promoting the other records that were on the label. We had about 20 records in the catalog. So I was promoting the records in the catalog to jazz radio, and I was doing just general promotion work as well. Now, the really hip thing was, just like when I worked for CTI Records, I got to be out with Rudy Van Gelder. When I worked with Gene Perla with PM Records, he and the keyboard artist Jan Hammer, who people remember from then as part of the Mahavishnu Orchestra, and then later Miami Vice, I believe.
Yeah.
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 Jan Hammer and Gene Perla owned a studio together in upstate New York called Redgate Studios in Kent, New York.
Famous.
So I got to be up there a lot with Jan, and Jan and Gene would engineer the projects that went around up there. It was great to be in the studio with guys of this caliber.
And seeing what was important to them while they were recording and how
they approached things. Yeah, exactly. And actually, I have to say, I wasn't crazy about Jan personally, and that's okay. We don't have to love everybody like, you know, they're our next-door neighbor. But late at night, Jan would play acoustic piano, classical piano. Wow. He's originally from Czechoslovakia. You know, he and Miroslav Vitus, they grew up together.
Yeah.
And they both played classical music together when they were kids over there. And to hear Jan late at night, you know, play Chopin and all that stuff, oh, it was just fantastic. It was just wonderful.
Those off-the-clock moments.
Yeah, off-the-clock moment. Yeah. And another one of those little perks up there, being back in New York, was at the time that I was managing the group Stone Alliance, the drummer-percussionist Don Elias was going with Joni Mitchell. So when Joni was in town, she had a penthouse right by the Holland Tunnel, just down the street from the Brecker Brothers Club, 7th Avenue South, where we all used to hang out. I got to be Joni Mitchell's escort for a year. Whenever Dawn was on the road and Joni was in town and wanted to go somewhere, I was the designated date.
Right, exactly.
So now that was cool, man.
Oh, I bet.
Because Joni Mitchell
is an interesting person.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You couldn't get more interesting, you know? And once she tuned in that I wasn't just another, you know, record company guy.
Right.
You know, I was actually a musician. I knew the music. I'm an artist. I have business ability. Oh, man. We'd spend hours at her kitchen table drinking pear schnapps and arranging her album covers, particularly
she did a lot of her own art.
Yeah. Well, in fact, she had a studio there where I never was in the studio because she was kind of private about some stuff. But, she had a studio there, you know, and I remember the Shadows in Light record, the live record.
Oh, yeah.
That she did with the Breckers and Pat Metheny.
I saw that tour.
Yeah.
1980, San Francisco Civic Auditorium.
Yeah,
I
baby.
Had no advance notice. This is like one of those amazing things. I'm just, Joni Mitchell at the San Francisco, I'll go, because I had been really gotten turned on her at the Mingus album.
Yeah.
And so I go, I'm sitting up there, and I got a seat that's almost all the way around the side of the stage. There was like one cockeyed speaker pointing at me.
Oh, I got you.
And I'm looking down, and who walks onto the stage but Michael Brecker, right. Pat Metheny, Lyle Mays, Don Elias, and Jaco Pastorius on bass. I'm like, they don't even have to play it. I love this show.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
So Joni and I are sitting at her kitchen table, doing the layout, the graphic layout for that record that ultimately came called Shadows in Light.
Which I have.
With that group.
Yeah.
And there we were, man. She'd have this series of photos, and she would line them up a certain way, and she'd go, "Wow, Ron, what do you think? How do you think that looks?" I said, "Oh, that looks pretty good, Johnny. Yeah, you know." Then she'd do another arrangement. "What do you think about this?" And then after like the 10th arrangement, it's like, you know, hey, they all look the same to me. They all look good.
They're all the same photos.
Yeah, really. Just do whatever you want.
Wow. Designated date.
Yeah.
For Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. If she wanted to go to a movie or go out to eat, her favorite place to eat was this kind of deco-ish looking place called Elephant and Castle. I never know how it got its name, but anyway. Yeah, we'd be walking down the street in Manhattan sometimes, and you could see people looking.
Yeah.
You know, is that Joni? That's Joni Mitchell. You know, and there she is. I'm on her arm.
Oh, man. I never knew that about you. That is so badass.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I got story after story. You know, I could tell you all about hanging out at the Brecker's Club, 7th Avenue South. You know,
tell us a little bit about that.
All right, so the Brecker brothers at that time were them and Steve Gadd and Will Lee and all these people. They're all first call studio guys. they basically, I don't think these guys ever went home, honestly. I think, you know, they had a little bed in some cheap apartment in Midtown that they go and lay down for an hour and then go back to the studio, you know. But you'd walk into 7th Avenue South on any given late afternoon, and there, sitting at the bar, Steve Gadd, Will Lee, Randy Brecker, Michael Brecker, Bob Mincer, you know, the list goes on and on. And then upstairs, you'd hear guys playing. And so upstairs in the afternoon, Jaco Pastorius, Kenwood Denard, Alex Blake, they're just upstairs playing. There it is.
Yeah, just for the hell of it.
Just for the hell of it, right. They're musicians.
Imagine.
This is what we do. We're in our place. The Breckers own this club. We're in with them. It's all good. So there it is.
Fantastic.
And because I had all these little hookups, I was part of that little crowd, you know. I mean, I wasn't the main cog or anything, of course, but yeah, I got to hang out. I got to be with these people because I was in the business.
And that was a golden age, too,
don't
you think?
Oh, geez. I want to tell you. It was.
Yeah, let's pursue that a little bit. From a business perspective, what do you think is fundamentally different about what was going on then as opposed to what's going on now in the business?
Wow.
That kind of thing. Well, is there some kind of core thing?
That's an interesting question. And I don't know if I'm able, in all honesty, Bill, to really totally answer that. Look, the music business has always been about making money, okay? Let's don't kid ourselves, folks, all right? I mean, that's what it's always been about.
Well, that's why it's the music business.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It seemed, at least there in New York, there was a real camaraderie. Because it's interesting, if you look at all the records, particularly commercial records, that came out at that period, there's probably only about 15 or 20 guys that made all those records with whoever we're talking about. Stevie Wonder to Carly Simon.
Well, sure. And, you know, Michael Brecker was the sax guy for Paul Simon.
Right, yeah. Right. There was all these hookups, and it was totally about the music. I mean, guys wanted to get paid. Musicians always want to get paid, okay? And that was there, but it was really, everybody knew each other. Everybody was playing with each other. There was so much crossover. I see maybe some of that crossover more in the jam band thing these days. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's really changed a lot. I mean, we know distribution has completely changed.
Right.
Record companies are only marketing outfits these days in reality. I mean, the whole model has changed. You know, when an outfit like Columbia Records hires a guy like Rick Rubin, you know, to turn the whole thing around, you know you're in a whole other scene here now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the impact of technology can't be denied, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, it's good. It definitely changes the whole thing away from being large company-oriented to being individual-oriented.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, anybody can make a world-class record now. Anybody,
yeah,
you know, in their bedroom, for by and large, you know.
As long as they can keep the drum set from falling off the bed.
Yeah, exactly, right, right. I'm still kind of a recording studio guy myself. But
well, it depends. It's, you know, there's all different types of music, and you record it all different ways. I mean,
yeah.
You know, does it make any sense to go to a $125 an hour studio if all you're going to do is run direct into the board?
For your synth, right, yeah. Exactly.
You know, no, I mean, that makes no sense.
Right. So. You know, and it's funny, now that you bring that up, while I was in New York, there in the early 80s, I did produce some professional demo sessions. Like a label was interested in somebody, but before really signing them, they wanted to bring them into the studio and hear what they sound like. I supervised a few sessions for Atlantic Records like that with the engineer, David Baker. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. David Baker. He was that guy that engineered all the American ECM records stuff.
Oh, right,
You know, love David Baker. So, I mean, I got to be in the studio with some guys like the guitar player Dean Brown, you know, who played with Billy Cobham, and, you know, some of the fusion-y kind of stuff that was going on there.
And they became some of the session musicians for this,
right,
for this developmental project.
Yeah, right. I like producing. I love being in the studio. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With the lights down.
Yeah, with the lights down, with the right people, you know, there it is.
Yeah, it's a magical environment. It's,
it is. It is very, very magical.
To it for, yeah, yeah. Forever. So you were managing that one band.
Yeah, Stone Alliance.
Stone Alliance. So tell us more about managing the band. Now, that's more than just road managing, which is really about the logistics of travel.
Yeah. Yeah, when you manage a band, basically, you know, you're in charge of the growth and development of the group as a commercial, artistic entity. So you're paying attention to everything from image to the compositions to the recording to getting gigs, making sure that promotional material is available and being sent out and all that type of thing.
Are you marketing the band to agencies?
Yeah,
so you can
right.
Get work?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Right.
So you contact the agent saying, hey, we're available. We've
got
this.
In fact, I even had an appointment with the late John Hammond one time.
Wow.
And what a coup in one regard, okay? But interestingly enough, I had a half-hour appointment with him, and he spent 25 minutes on a punctuation error I made in my cover letter to him. Can you believe it? Here's the guy that, you know, brought Billie Holiday, Bruce Springsteen,
right.
Bob Dylan, et cetera, et cetera,
et cetera. Was he busting your chops because you had a master's and you had a comma in the wrong place?
Exactly. That's exactly what he did. And there he was. John Hammond behind his desk with that shock of gray hair and all these gold records everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, telling me how am I going to be credible to someone like him in regard to the group that I'm trying to sell him if I can't punctuate correctly.
I'm selling you the music, not the punctuation.
I know. I know. Must have been a bad hair day for my man. So that was my one and only shot at John Hammond.
Did he hire you at the end of that?
No.
Okay, proof there that punctuation really does fucking matter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. At least with the old school.
Yeah, with the old school, right, exactly.
So something I want to discuss a little bit more about that. So you said you had something to do with the compositions. Now, you're not really working with a group as a producer, which means you don't really have control over any of that. But at the same time, you have to pay attention to it because it would be possible for them to become so fragmented in their direction that you can't sell them anymore.
Yeah, right?
Right.
Yeah. It's like, well, you know, there has to be a focus to what we're cutting here, okay?
Right.
And
was there ever any explicitly defined direction for the group? Like, okay, for this particular aggregation of people, our goal is to do this kind of thing.
Right. Stone Alliance, particularly on Gene Perla and Don Elias's end, they had lived and worked in Brazil and were seriously influenced by Brazilian musicians who Americans would never even ever know about,
right.
Okay? If you were a musician, you might, okay? So they were deep into the culture. And so Stone Alliance's foundation was a lot of this Brazilian, South American rhythmic thing with really hard-driving sax and spaced electric keyboard stuff. So you had this rhythmic thing going on. You kind of had this spatial textural thing. And then you had like this, not quite like Coltrane, but this really hard-edged tenor Bobby Mensah playing. This hard-edged tenor thing going on, you know. So it was...
This was an explicitly stated out in the open, this is the way we want this group
to
be. And so it was your job to kind of make sure that things didn't get too far afield?
I mean, these guys are highly experienced players, so...
You didn't really have to intervene, though.
Yeah, it's not so much intervening. It was more, you know, tune selection, the order... This type of stuff.
Awful lot of slow tunes in a row, that kind of thing.
Yeah, right. You know, interfacing with the album layout and design and manufacturing. It was really interesting. You know, we used to go out to Long Island, where we used to manufacture, and see the manufacturing process. It was unbelievable. The mother, the master.
The stamper.
The stamper, right.
Right, right.
And you'd see
lacquers and
the
acetate.
Lacquer come off, this come out the sides of when it's being pressed. And
flash. And,
it looks
yeah.
like tar, you know what I'm saying?
And oh, yeah.
Just, you know, the whole, the whole process, you know, just the micro groove thing, you know.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, it was really...
Trying to make advancements in what's fundamentally a flawed technology.
Yeah, yeah, pretty wild, right, exactly. Yeah.
And, of course, you know, guys like that would be concerned about sound quality, whereas
right.
a lot of rock guys, I mean, it's basically just about how loud can you make the record.